We're going to read together from God's Word in 2 Samuel and chapter 17. 2 Samuel 17, the context here is Absalom's rebellion. So verse 1, Ahithophel said to Absalom, I would choose 12,000 men and set out tonight in pursuit of David. I would attack him while he is weary and weak. I would strike him with terror, and then all the people with him will flee. I would strike down only the king and bring all the people back to you. The death of the man you seek will mean the return of all. All the people will be unharmed. This plan seemed good to Absalom and to all the elders of Israel. But Absalom said, summon also Hushai the Archite, so that we can hear what he has to say. When Hushai came to him, Absalom said, Ahithophel has given this advice. Should we do what he says? If not, give us your opinion. Hushai replied to Absalom, the advice Ahithophel has given is not good this time. You know your father and his men. They are fighters and as fierce as a wild bear robbed of her cubs. Besides, your father is an experienced fighter. He will not spend the night with the troops. Even now he is hidden in a cave or some other place. If he should attack your troops first, whoever hears about it will say, there has been a slaughter among the troops who follow Absalom. Then even the bravest soldier, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will melt with fear. For all Israel knows that your father is a fighter and that those with him are brave. So I advise you, let all Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, as numerous as the sand on the seashore, be gathered to you, with you yourself leading them into battle. Then we will attack him wherever he may be found, and we will fall on him as dew settles on the ground. Neither he nor any of his men will be left alive. If he withdraws into a city, then all Israel will bring ropes to that city, and we will drag it down to the valley until not even a piece of it can be found. Absalom and all the men of Israel said, the advice of Hushai the Archite is better than that of Ahithophel. For the Lord had determined to frustrate the good advice of Ahithophel in order to bring disaster on Absalom. And then we're just going to jump down to verse 23. When Ahithophel saw that his advice had not been followed, he saddled his donkey and set out for his house in his hometown. He put his house in order and then hanged himself. So he died and was buried in his father's tomb. David went to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan with all the men of Israel. Absalom had appointed Amasa over the army in place of Joab. Amasa was the son of a man named Jether, an Israelite who had married Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, and sister of Zeruiah, the mother of Joab. The Israelites and Absalom camped in the land of Gilead. When David came to Mahanaim, Shobi, son of Nahash from Rabbah of the Ammonites, and Machir, son of Amiel from Lo-Debar, and Barzillai the Gileadite from Rogalim, brought bedding and bowls and articles of pottery. They also brought wheat and barley, flour and roasted grain, beans and lentils, honey and curd, sheep and cheese from cow's milk, for David and his people to eat. For they said, the people have become hungry and tired and thirsty in the deserts. And then just jumping forward for one final section in chapter 19. And we'll read from verse 31. By which time Absalom's rebellion is over and David is on his way back to Jerusalem. Verse 31. Barzillai the Gileadite also came down from Rogalim to cross the Jordan with the king and to send him on his way from there. Now Barzillai was a very old man, 80 years of age. He had provided for the king during his stay in Mahanaim, for he was a very wealthy man. The king said to Barzillai, cross over with me and stay with me in Jerusalem, and I will provide for you. But Barzillai answered the king, how many more years shall I live that I should go up to Jerusalem with the king? I am now 80 years old. Can I tell the difference between what is good and what is not? Can your servant taste what he eats and drinks? Can I still hear the voices of men and women singers? Why should your servant be an added burden to my lord the king? Your servant will cross over the Jordan with the king for a short distance, But why should the king reward me in this way? Let your servant return, that I may die in my own town near the tomb of my father and mother. But here is your servant Kimham. Let him cross over with my lord the king. Do for him whatever pleases you. The king said, Kimham shall cross over with me, and I will do for him whatever pleases you. And anything you desire from me, I will do for you. So all the people crossed the Jordan, and then the king crossed over. The king kissed Barzillai and gave him his blessing, and Barzillai returned to his home. Amen. Well, I'm sure many of you are familiar with the life of David, and familiar, therefore, with many individuals whose lives in some way intersected with David's life. Saul and Jonathan and Samuel and Goliath and Abigail and Joab, and so we could go on. But one individual with whom you may not be quite so familiar is Barzillai. And yet Barzillai was another man whose life intersected with David's life. And so this morning, I would like us just to spend a few minutes considering this fascinating Old Testament character, Barzillai. And I hope that as we do so, we can profit from the exercise. And so we're going to look at this man, and we're going to do so under two main headings. So notice with me, first of all, he's a welcome man. He's a welcome man. So Barzillai's brief appearance in David's story occurs at a very bleak point. Within that story, things are hugely depressing for David at this juncture. As I mentioned earlier on, Absalom is conducting his rebellion. And so I suppose for David to have to endure any large-scale rebellion, any attempted coup, was bad enough. But when that attempt to wrest the throne from him was coming from within his own family, well, that must have been absolutely devastating for the man. And of course, this was no lame, unrealistic bid by Absalom for Israel's throne. This was serious stuff, so serious, in fact, that David here is fleeing. He's fleeing Jerusalem for his very life. He's having to get out of the place altogether. That's how bad things are. So that's the depressing setting. How does Barzillai fit into all this? Well, as David and his companions flee, Barzillai suddenly turns up with a whole load of provisions for David and his men. Just basic necessities in the realms of sleeping and washing and eating in order to keep these men going. And so you can see then, can't you, how against this dark backdrop, Barzillai's appearance is a bit of welcome relief for David. In fact, I think you can sense it in that rather unnecessarily long list of items that we have at the end of chapter 17 there. I mean, you think the narrator could have just summed up this by saying something like Barzillai and the others brought along a pile of stuff. But instead, he kind of itemizes all these things, and it just seems a bit unwieldy and a bit cumbersome, this list. But I think it's almost giving the reader an insight into David's own relish at receiving this gift. I mean, if you're going through a period where you're being got at by people and you're feeling somewhat unloved, and then suddenly one morning there arrives on your doorstep a hamper from Marks and Spencer's, then you might well get on the phone to a friend and tell your friend all about this. And you might kind of go through with your friend everything that's in that hamper. There's hot chocolate in there. There are cookies in there. There's cheese in there. There's coffee in there. There are all these different things. And your friend doesn't need to know all that. But each item you mention is driving it home to you that little bit more. Someone does love me. Someone does care about me. Somebody has sent me these things. And so I think the narrator, he's capturing David's own perspective almost in the way that he records this long list at the end of chapter 17. So in a very obvious way then, Barzillai is for David a welcome man. But in that connection, I just want to probe this a little bit more deeply, and I want to uncover three encouraging principles here. So principle number one, the wonder of God's grace. The wonder of God's grace. You see, it's always important, whenever we're considering this whole episode of David's life, to remember that the Absalom rebellion, it's not some random, mysterious phenomenon that suddenly blows up in David's life. No, this is the fulfillment of prophecy. Nathan's prophecy to David, back in chapter 12, in the aftermath of David's adultery with Bathsheba and his subsequent arranging of the death of Bathsheba's husband Uriah. And you remember how, following all that, David goes for many months seemingly impervious and oblivious to what he's done, until the Lord sends Nathan along to convict David. And you remember how Nathan does that, and how he tells that searching little story about the man with the sheep, and you know how that goes. And you remember how Nathan concludes the story so emphatically there in verse 7 of chapter 12, "You are the man." And then this is how he continues. "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I anointed you king over Israel, and I delivered you from the hand of Saul. I gave your master's house to you and your master's wives into your arms. I gave you the house of Israel and Judah, and if all this had been too little, I would have given you even more. Why did you despise the word of the Lord by doing what is evil in his eyes? You struck down Uriah the Hittite with the sword and took his wife to be your own. You killed him with the sword of the Ammonites. Now, therefore, the sword shall never depart from your house, because you despised me and took the wife of Uriah the Hittite to be your own." So you see it there, the sword shall never depart from your house. Nathan is prophesying bloodshed and violence within David's own family. And yes, at one level, then it's going to be a recurring pattern of bloodshed and violence over a long period of time. But at the same time, Nathan has in mind one kind of climactic expression of this bloodshed and violence. Because this is how he continues in that chapter. "This is what the Lord says. Out of your own household, I am going to bring calamity upon you. Before your very eyes, I will take your wives and give them to one who is close to you, and he will lie with your wives in broad daylight." Now, Absalom did that. So, yes, Nathan is prophesying a pattern of violence within David's family, but he's also specifically prophesying one climactic expression, namely Absalom's rebellion. So I'm saying Absalom's rebellion, it's not random. It's not some mysterious providence. It's the consequence of David's sin. And David himself seems to recognize that. If you just glance back at chapter 16, verse 11, this is when David is on his way out of Jerusalem. And you remember, he suffers that further indignity of this guy Shimei turning up on the scene and throwing insults at David. And you remember how David's companions, they're outraged by this, and they say, "Let us go and sort this guy Shimei out. We'll go and deal with him." And David says, "No." And this is what he says, chapter 16, 11. "My son, who is of my own flesh, is trying to take my life. How much more than this Benjamite? Let him alone. Let him curse. For the Lord has told him to." I don't think David there is just talking about providence generally, that everything that ever happens is ultimately ordained and commanded by God, and so Shimei cursing me now has been, in that general sense, ordained and commanded by God. No, he's not talking about providence, he's talking about judgment here. He's recognizing in what Shimei is doing to him the hand of God, because God is chastising David for what he's done. So here then, God is sternly dealing with his badly erring servant. And yet, the remarkable thing is that even as he's been so stern toward David, his grace comes through. Even as he's in the process of disciplining David, God sends Barzillai along with a pile of provisions for David. With one hand, God is chastising David. With the other hand, he's pouring out blessings still upon David. It's almost as though God's grace is so instinctive, it's so irrepressible, he just can't help himself. He just can't bring himself to be all sternness and nothing else toward one of his own children. What a God we have, don't we? What a God we have. He's certainly not the spineless, effeminate, all-endorsing Father Christmas-like God of so much contemporary Christianity. No, he does take David's sin very seriously. He sends Absalom along to cause all this trouble. But nor toward his own blood-bought children is he the harsh, grudge-bearing, always accusing God that our troubled consciences often imagine him to be. Now, in the midst of his fatherly anger toward David, he does not stop being kind. He still sends Barzillai along to help him and serve him and administer comfort to him. What a God we have. How breathtaking, how mysterious, how incomparable, how uninventable is his grace. In the midst of dealing with David, he blesses David, because that's the kind of God we have. So that's principle number one, the wonder of God's grace. Principle number two, the packaging of God's blessings. The packaging of God's blessings. Now, we're focusing on Barzillai this morning, but there are actually three men who turn up there at the end of chapter 17. You may have noticed that. And as David saw those three men coming, and as they got close enough to him for him to properly take them in, I very much doubt David's heart leapt at the prospect of this encounter. I mean, they're a fairly motley crew, aren't they? So, first of all, we have Shobi. And David may not have known Shobi, but would have immediately recognized him by his appearance to be a foreigner. Shobi was an Ammonite, we're told. And then there's this man, Machir, who's mentioned. Now, David would have known him. And he would have known that Machir was closely associated with Saul's family. Back in chapter 9, remember how David wanted to show kindness to a descendant of Jonathan. And so he asks, is there anybody left? And he's told, well, yes, there's one of Jonathan's sons, Mephibosheth. And so he says, well, where is he? And he's directed to this man, Machir, because Machir is kind of the guardian of Mephibosheth. So he has these close associations with Saul's family. And then there's Barzillai. And David may not have known him, but he would have been immediately struck, no doubt, by Barzillai's elderliness and by the frailty that went along with that. Now, notice the location where this encounter takes place. I think that's important. It takes place at Mahanaim. What does the name Mahanaim mean? Mahanaim means two camps. It was named that by Jacob at the beginning of Genesis 32. You'll know the passage. Jacob is on his way back from those 20 years in exile, and he's going to meet his brother Esau. And of course, he doesn't know what's going to happen, and he's stressed about this because Esau, of course, 20 years ago had wanted to kill him. What's Esau going to be like now? What's his reception of Jacob going to be? And so these are troubling times that Jacob is facing there. But you remember how God encourages Jacob there in that situation. And he sends, it seems, a troop of angels to encourage Jacob. And that's why Jacob calls the place Mahanaim, two camps. He's saying, well, there's my camp. There's me and my two wives and my concubines and all my children and my livestock and my stuff. There's my camp here. But there's another camp. There's this angelic camp, this celestial, heavenly camp that God has graciously sent for my encouragement. And so that was a great solace and a great lift for Jacob. He was encouraged in that way on that occasion. Now here's David. And he's in similarly troubled circumstances. Only with him, it's not his brother that's the problem. It's his son that's the problem. And yet David sees no troop of angels. Just three men walking toward him. One of them a foreigner, so probably hostile. One of them close associations with Saul's family, so probably has issues. The other one, old and frail, what's he got to offer? And then these three men open their mouths. And they say, David, we've got a pile of stuff for you. The smile must have crept across David's face. Mahanaim was living up to its name and its history. After all, God was blessing him there, just as many years earlier he'd blessed Jacob there. Only in David's case, the blessing comes in a much more surprising packaging. Not a troop of angels, but three unlikely looking men. Isn't that how God often blesses us? Blessings in unlikely packaging. I sometimes think about Naomi there in Moab. And I wonder what Naomi's reaction was the first day that her son Mahlon brought his new girlfriend Ruth back to the house. Perhaps immediately she thought, seems a nice girl. Perhaps maternal protectiveness kicked in and she resented Ruth coming into the house. Perhaps quite properly she had misgivings about this because Ruth was a Moabitess. We don't know, but certainly Naomi could never have imagined in that moment that this girl, Ruth, would prove to be the greatest divine blessing of her entire life. That this girl, Ruth, would provide for her, Naomi, in the destitution of widowhood. And more than that, through this girl, Ruth, she, Naomi, would nurse a child in her old age, a child who would even be an ancestor of the Messiah himself. She could never have envisaged that the day she first met Ruth. God's blessings in surprising packaging. And if we grasped this principle ourselves, might we not approach our different situations tomorrow morning with a bit more relish? Not, oh no, another day in this office. Not, oh no, an 8-hour flight seated next to this person. But rather, how might God be blessing me today in this set of circumstances, despite its unpromising appearance? The wonder of God's grace, the packaging of God's blessings. Principle number three, the quietness of God's victory. The quietness of God's victory. I read quite a bit of chapter 17 earlier on. And chapter 17, it's interesting. I think it's intended to convey to us something of a paradox. You see, on the surface of chapter 17, God's enemies are triumphing. Absalom has Jerusalem. He's taken the city. David, on the other hand, is on his way out. He's fleeing the city. And so that's the story on every Israelite news channel every night. That's the headline. That's the news. Absalom has Jerusalem. David's fleeing. Things look pretty bad. On the surface of things, God's enemies are triumphing. But when you probe beneath the surface, a different story starts to emerge. So Absalom's only hope of success, the brilliant counselor Ahithophel, whom he is lord, of course, from David's side, he has quietly gone to his hometown and taken his own life. Hushai, who in fact is loyal to David, is quietly feeding Absalom bad advice in order to ruin him. And now, at the end of the chapter, David's needs are quietly being met by Barzillai and his two associates. And so it's all very low-key and it's all very understated. It's all beneath the radar. But God's cause is quietly flourishing here, despite the surface appearance. And again, isn't it often like that? So we hear on the news today, don't we, so much about Islamic State, the cities that they're taking, the historical treasures they're destroying, the atrocities they're committing. It's headline stuff. We hear about it all the time. What we don't hear about is all those people in the Muslim world who, precisely because of all that, are becoming disillusioned with Islam and in many cases are turning to faith in Jesus Christ. That doesn't make the 10 o'clock news on the BBC. God just being quietly victorious. Or bringing it closer to home, we hear all these statistics, don't we, about how Christianity is waning in the United Kingdom, all these depressing church attendance figures and so on. That makes the headlines. But your growth in holiness over the last few months and my growth in holiness, that never makes the 10 o'clock news, does it? The fact that by the Spirit of God empowering us, and this is as big a miracle as the creation of the universe itself, the fact that by the Spirit of God empowering us, we are becoming better husbands and wives, better fathers and mothers and children, more faithful citizens, more diligent employees, fairer employers. The fact that we are overcoming the residual flesh within us and becoming more like Jesus Christ, that is miraculous. Never gets reported on the news. God just being quietly victorious. And so I'm saying then that here's Barzillai. And yes, in a very obvious way for David at this point, he's a welcome man. And it points us to these three principles: the wonder of God's grace, the packaging of God's blessings, and the quietness of God's victory. But then our second main heading this morning: he's a welcome man, he's a wedded man. He's a wedded man. Now, I don't mean he's literally wedded, although presumably Barzillai was married because we read about his children. But what I mean is he's wedded to David. That's the great thing, isn't it, about Barzillai. All Israel is being swept off its feet by Absalom. Absalom is young. Absalom is handsome. Absalom is slick. Absalom is impressive. Everybody is just being wowed by Absalom. But Barzillai isn't. David is the divinely chosen king, and Absalom is not. And as far as Barzillai is concerned, that settles the matter. Barzillai is loyal to King David. And you don't need to be an expert theologian to see immediately the obvious application of that to ourselves. David, of course, anticipates a greater divinely chosen king, King Jesus. And we then are to be, in relation to King Jesus, what Barzillai was in relation to King David. We are to show loyalty to King Jesus. Now, this concept of loyalty, it's not a particularly glamorous one, is it? It's not a glamorous concept in our society, certainly. I have a feeling that even within the church, loyalty often isn't a particularly talked of and glamorous subject. I'm often struck by Luke 22, you know how in Luke 22 it's the Last Supper, and we have that extraordinary situation there at the Last Supper, Jesus on the threshold of Golgotha, there eating that meal with his disciples, and we read in Luke 22:24, a dispute arose among them as to which of them was considered to be greatest. Astonishing, isn't it? And so there's Peter. And he's saying, you know what, boys, I think I'm a bit better than you, actually. I'm a bit more important. I walked on water. None of you lot have ever walked on water. And then Andrew butts in, ah, yeah, but hang on a minute, Peter. Who first cottoned on to the fact that Jesus was the Messiah? It wasn't you, was it? I told you that. I think I'm a bit greater than you, actually, Peter. And then John gets in on the act. Ah, but who is it that sits next to Jesus and rests his head on Jesus' bosom? Who's doing that at this very moment? It's me. It's not you guys. And I think, therefore, I'm a bit more important than you. And so it goes on, and they're all advancing their competing claims for greatness. It's so crass. And Jesus has to deal with that. And in the context of dealing with it, he says something which seems on the face of things a non sequitur. It seems to come out of nowhere. It seems utterly unrelated to the whole thing. He says this in verse 28. You are those who have stood by me in my trials. You think, what's that got to do with it? Well, his point is this. that true greatness, greatness in the sight of God, is not walking on water. And it's not discovering that I'm the Messiah before anybody else discover that I'm the Messiah. It's not even resting your head on my bosom. No, greatness in the sight of God is loyalty to me. It's sticking by me in my trials, even when nobody else is sticking by me. I came into this city a week ago and there were crowds from Galilee accompanying me, and they were all laying their coats on the street and they were waving palm branches, and those crowds are nowhere to be seen anymore. And then throughout this week, I've been teaching in the temple precincts, and there have been crowds listening to me from Jerusalem. Those crowds are nowhere to be seen anymore. And then as we started off this meal, there were 12 of you with me, having communion and fellowship with me. Now there are only 11 of you because one has already defected. And you can see then how Jesus is becoming more and more unpopular, and more people are walking away from him. And he's saying, this is greatness in God's sight, to not walk away from me, just to stick by me and be loyal to me, no matter how unpopular I am in everybody else's eyes. That's greatness. And I think that so often in the modern church even, we can be where those disciples were at in their silly arguments. And so often we're bedazzled, aren't we, by the Christian superstars, the great conference speakers and authors whom we place on pedestals and so on. Often not their fault, it's we who do it. And Barzillai then is a reminder to us of this great virtue of loyalty, just being loyal to God's king. And in that connection then, as we close, just notice three things about Barzillai's loyalty. First of all, it's disinterested loyalty. Notice disinterested, not uninterested. Uninterested means apathetic and not bothered. Disinterested means that you don't stand to gain from something. You don't have a personal interest in it. You're doing it not for selfish reasons. And that was the case with Barzillai's loyalty. You see, it's not that Barzillai is a clever chap. And he's very far-sighted. And he can see that this Absalom rebellion, it'll soon blow over. It'll soon be gone. And so he's thinking, well, if I remain loyal to David, then once Absalom's rebellion has blown over, David will be very pleased with me, and he'll reward me with all kinds of promotions. And so that's why I'm going to be loyal to David. That's not the case. We know that. Because, of course, the Absalom rebellion does blow over. And David does want to reward Barzillai. And Barzillai says, no thanks. I don't want your rewards. That's not why I'm being loyal to you. It's disinterested loyalty. You know, I think it's sometimes a useful exercise to stop ourselves and ask ourselves, why, when you strip everything else away, why am I loyal to King Jesus? Why am I subject to King Jesus this morning? Why do I keep going as a Christian? Why am I loyal to King Jesus? What are my reasons? What are my motives deep within? You know how we often say, don't we, that the first gospel promise is there in Genesis 3:15. And I guess it is. But it's a funny kind of promise. It's not really a promise at all, is it? It's actually more of a threat. It's not spoken to Adam and Eve, is it? It's not God saying to Adam and Eve there in the garden, I'm going to send a Savior who will atone for your sins. No, it's God saying to the serpent, I'm going to send a conqueror who will smash your skull to pieces. The first gospel promise is actually a threat to the serpent. Yet, you see, we so instinctively put ourselves at the heart of the whole gospel story, don't we? And we think then that God, that Jesus is our king who defeats our enemies and secures our everlasting glory. Whereas actually, he's primarily God's king who defeats God's enemies and restores God's glory. That's the biblical picture. And I think Barzillai then kind of understands that framework. He's not loyal to David because of what's in it for him. He's loyal to David because David, in a provisional Old Testament sense, is God's king who defeats God's enemies and restores God's glory. Is that why you're loyal to Jesus this morning? Or to put it another way, what is it that you are looking forward to on that day when Jesus Christ returns? Is it all the rewards that he's going to lavish upon you? Well, that's okay. The Bible holds those out to us as things that we should be looking forward to, certainly. But are you also, and indeed are you primarily, looking forward to that day? Because on that day, Jesus will have won. And the kingdom will be his. And he will be rightfully recognized for who he is. And every knee will bow to him. And every tongue confess that he is Lord to the glory of God the Father. Shouldn't that be the thing that fires us up more than anything as we think about the last day? It's disinterested loyalty. Secondly, notice it's elderly loyalty. It's elderly loyalty. Barzillai's elderliness is described with such stark realism, isn't it, by Barzillai himself there in chapter 19. The way he talks about not being able to taste his food anymore, not being able to listen to singers anymore. By the way, it's a reminder to us, isn't it, of the utter futility of living for wealth. Barzillai is a wealthy man, it says that in verse 32. He's a wealthy man, yet here he is and he can't now enjoy the benefits of all his wealth. He can buy the best food that's going, can't taste it. Can buy the best entertainment going, can't hear it. The futility of living for something whose benefits are so precarious, so short-lived. Live only for that which old age cannot tear from you. Live only for that which even death cannot tear from you. And there's only one thing that fits those criteria. That's Jesus. Live for Jesus Christ. But Barzillai, of course, he's not living for his wealth anyway. And my point here then is that here he is, and he may have displayed loyalty to David in many other ways prior to this. But the only expression of loyalty we know about in Barzillai's life is here when he's an old man. And you think, well, what can Barzillai do? He can't join the forces who are fighting against Absalom out there on the battlefield. He can't do that. What can he do? He can't do anything. He's useless. No, he's not useless. He can't do much. But what he does, boy, it encourages David at this point. He brings these provisions and gives them to him. And you know, there is never a point when we are too old or too infirm or too weak or too laid aside to still be of use to King Jesus. And some of us perhaps need to hear that this morning. Perhaps you feel that now you're over the hill in some way and no longer of any value to King Jesus. It's not so. Barzillai was of just as much value to King David as Joab or any of those fighting men were at this point. Whatever stage we're at, whatever our condition, however low, however weak, we can always be of use to King Jesus. It's disinterested loyalty, it's elderly loyalty. Finally, it's remembered loyalty. It's remembered loyalty. You might think, well, in the grand scheme of things, is it really such a big deal what Barzillai does here, bringing these provisions to David? I mean, okay, it brings a smile to David's face at the time, but in the big picture, I mean, is it such a big deal? It'll soon be forgotten. Well, it wasn't soon forgotten. David was reinstated as king in Jerusalem. He went on to rule for many years and achieve many things, never forgot what Barzillai did for him that day. We know that because in 1 Kings chapter 2, David himself is an old man. David is dying. And Barzillai is presumably long dead by now. And David is giving instructions to Solomon as he ascends to the throne. And this is one of them. 1 Kings 2, verse 7. Show kindness to the sons of Barzillai of Gilead, and let them be among those who eat at your table. They stood by me when I fled from your brother Absalom. He hadn't forgotten. Amidst all the mighty exploits and epic sagas of David's reign, he hadn't forgotten that one moment when Barzillai turned up with a pile of provisions. And King Jesus doesn't forget, does he, either? Those astonishing words in Mark 9:41, "Truly I say to you, whoever gives you a cup of water to drink because you belong to Christ will by no means lose his reward." What's a cup of water in the grand scheme of things? But Jesus notices those little things we do, those little words of encouragement we speak to a brother or sister who's struggling, the phone call, the email, the little bit of practical help. Nobody else notices, and we're not doing it to be noticed by anyone else. But Jesus does notice, and he values, he treasures that little act of loyalty to him. And of course, the great point here then, with which we must conclude, is this: that if King David was worth Barzillai being so loyal to him, how much more worth our loyalty is King Jesus? I mean, David was a flawed king. As we've already said this morning, he could fall into adultery. He could arrange the death of a man who was an inconvenient presence in his life. David was a flawed king, and yet Barzillai was this loyal to him. We have the most perfect king. Or perhaps you don't. Perhaps you've never come to King Jesus. Perhaps you've never said, in the words of the old hymn, "King of my life, I crown thee now." And if not, that's where you need to begin this morning. You need to come under the kingship of Jesus Christ. You need to become a willing subject of his. And I urge you to do that. But for all of us who are subjects of King Jesus, will we be loyal to our King, who is infinitely greater than David? Will we be Barzillai's toward him? Will we stick with him in a society where Jesus is deeply unpopular and becoming ever more so? Will we be loyal subjects of this wonderful King? May it be so. Amen.